It certainly is a wonderful book.
Yeah, thank you.
And what a wonderful way to distill history in a novelistic form. I want to ask you some questions about that because...
A lot of people don't understand it. If I write a book about World War II, you should have done it 20 years ago, you know. My whole point is to try to show the uselessness of the whole damn thing. And I felt I didn't do it sufficiently in my histories. I wanted to humanize it more and make people feel as if they are there.
I'd like to know a little more about that. You have indeed written magnificent histories of the war. You won the Pulitzer Prize, in fact. And yet, here you are at this late age, late stage in your life.
Late age is right.
Turning to fiction. I would imagine that you have built the foundation for this work of fiction on your knowledge as a historian.
Well, that's what it's based on. I've known I was going to do this for 20 years, but first I wanted to sufficiently ground myself in World War II, not only in Europe, but in the Pacific. Now I want to go further. I've done the war in Gods of War through the experiences of two families, one Japanese and one American. My next book will be called Occupation, and this takes the same characters and puts them in to the fall of 1945, and I'm trying to recreate that the way it was. Most people have no idea what our occupation was like. There's been very little written about it that was read popularly. And my characters now will be going through this tremendous experiment, probably the greatest experiment of all time, of a conqueror coming into a conquered land and turning a feudal society, which they think is feudal, into a democracy. And it was an astounding task, and the amazing thing is we accomplished about, 50% of what we tried to do. And did it in a way that 200 years from now, people are going to point to the occupation as an amazing change in human nature. And for the first time, here are occupiers actually trying to think of the problems of the defeated. Many, many mistakes were made, ridiculous ones. The trials, for example, the original trials of Yamashita and Homa were travesties. And yet when we got down to the trials of the main characters, Tojo and so forth, it took us 2.5 years. We learned through it. And the exciting thing is, the main defenders of the Japanese are American lawyers. And my young man, the hero of my book, Will, who has gone through hell in this book, he's been on Bataan in a death march, he's been in camps. He finally winds up in a camp in Nagasaki and goes through that hell. He gets out wanting never to go back to Japan he had previously loved. And his law firm is sending him back to help defend Tojo. And this, the professor, for example, McGlynn, he has been sent back to be an advisor to General MacArthur, as he was a sort of an informal advisor to Roosevelt before. Now he has more official chance to do this. He sees this man that utterly appalls him at first, and then he becomes amazed how this man, MacArthur, can be awful on Monday, wonderful on Tuesday, understanding on Thursday, Friday not understanding anything, and somehow coming out as the only American, I think, that could have been the proconsul of Japan.
We're really getting ahead in a way. It sounds to me as though you're immersed in that second volume. Yeah.
The first one is, these are like children, you know. The first one is in college, and I don't have to worry about it.
What is the third episode in the trilogy? What area will that cover?
Now, the second one will end the end of 1948. The third begins in 1949. We've already seen the Civil War in China. And I've been to China already, and they have agreed to help me. Had wonderful experiences over there. And we'll show the Civil War not only from the Kuomintang side, but from the Communist side. And one of our main characters, of course, the father of the Japanese family, had spent the war in China running this big steel mine, an ore factory. And He stays over there for some 6 or 7 months, and so through his eyes you see this horrendous civil war that's starting. And then it goes through to about 1953, because then we get into the Korean War. And this is the damnedest mess I have ever read about. Of course, I don't think I'll ever do Vietnam. Maybe when I'm 90, I'll do it. I vowed I would never do...
Have you started... what point are you in the third volume?
Well, the third is just... I can see it as a tremendous conglomeration of things that I don't understand.
No, I'm sorry, I didn't phrase it right.
The second one.
The second volume.
The second volume, I've been working on it for a year.
So you're well into the second.
Oh, yes. See, I've already been to Japan. I've been to the Philippines. I've been to China. And I will finish my research in the summer. And then in late fall, I'll be ready to start writing. And then it'll take me a year to get the first and second drafts, another 6 months to get the third and fourth, and maybe about the 87 or 8. I really don't care when they come out. It's when they're ready. But I am champing at the bit now, forced to go around to talk about Gods of War when I want to go home and work on this marvelous occupation. You know, you're going to really be proud of Americans. And they do some of the jerkiest things. We commit outrages there. Some of our officers are tremendous crooks. I've got some marvelous things of the thefts perpetrated by some of our people over there. I'll tell you, it's appalling what they got away with and have still gotten away with. But
like civilians.
Just right. But in other words, you see America at work. I love America because it's such a wreck. America is a Rube Goldberg concoction. That's democracy. And we are forced to repair this rattling, crumbling, bumbling machine while it moves. The fantastic thing is it keeps moving. And compared to all other forms of government, it's by far the best. But I like it because there's nothing finished about it. No matter what we accomplish, we're going to have to accomplish more. And thus, Americans are never satisfied. Americans, I find, are my best readers because they are willing to listen to their mistakes. Almost all of my books have been about the goofs of America. My first success was on the Battle of the Bulge, you know, which is a real screw-up, turned into what I think was a great triumph. Then I took the first 6 months after Pearl Harbor, which was really a mess. I've done a long biography on Hitler, and on my last one, which brought upon me Hot Fire, was infamy, in which I had the audacity to not only find material indicating that Roosevelt knew that the Japanese carriers were coming, but actually giving my opinion that he very well knew they were coming. And at the same time, I admire Roosevelt. He's wonderful to write about. He's like the occupation. And he has made so many mistakes, but somehow he comes out as bigger than life. The characters of World War II on all sides are bigger than life. And I think that's why it'll always be a fertile ground for novelists, historians, philosophers, and newscasters.
In spite of the horror and the brutality that you depict so well in Gods of War, in many respects, some people refer to it, and maybe you could challenge this statement, some people refer to it as the good war.
The good war? Egad. Was there ever a good war? But I'll tell you, it was a good war from the point of view of those of us who had to serve. Before the war, I was very left-wing. I was for peace. I picketed the White House, had a wonderful time doing all this. When Pearl Harbor came, I went down and I enlisted. And everybody in my unit enlisted. And we went out to fight the war. Of course, I ended up in New York City being this... helping run show business, but I thought all we want to do is get out there and fight the Japs, as we call them worse things than that. I hated the Japs. I hated the Germans. And then after the war, which I only fought mainly, my only battle, real battle, was in Biloxi, Mississippi, where I was at Keesler Air Force, and I had the stupidity, I guess you'd call it, to bring a black officer into the officer's club, and they tried to court-martial me. And I had it's going to be a wonderful chapter in my autobiography. All the horrible things that happened to me, it wound up, I ended up here in 43rd Street under John Schubert in show business.
Well,
it could only happen in the United States.
You would certainly prefer to have that sort of fate than the fate that Will had as a prisoner of war.
Will, see, I purposely picked Will as my protagonist. I wanted him to go through hell. But I wanted a man to go through hell who had been a complete success all his life. Here he is. Everybody loves Will. He is bright. He is for the right things. He went to Harvard. He Harvard Law School. He was Frankfurter's law clerk, and then he was Marshall's law officer. Then I sent him over to the Philippines to spy on MacArthur. A friend of mine, by the way, got this job. And he lands just as the Japanese are coming in. And so here's this man who's never gone through any failure in his life, flung in first the battles on Bataan, and then he's on the death march. And he's in the camps, and he finds to his horror that there are people whom he wouldn't have spoken to before the war who have more guts than he has and who save his life by giving him food when he's trying to hoard it. And he learns about humanity the hard way. And he learns also about himself, of the most of our people that lasted through the war as prisoners of war, which is the hardest thing to do. They were the best and the worst. The worst who connived and took food and water from their comrades, and the best were those that were at ease with themselves, and they either had some faith in themselves, faith in God, faith in their country, faith in doing right. And Will, of course, is an agnostic and so forth, but he finds that he can get through because of those around him, those whom he would never have talked to before, and he's learning about life. And he's the fellow that's going to have to go back and try to save Tojo.
John Tolan, in Gods of War, you depict a horrible, horrible brutality by the Japanese.
Oh, yes.
But at the same time, I have this feeling that you have an affection for the Japanese, and indeed, your wife is Japanese.
Yes. Well, they committed... All I'm doing in the book is telling what's happening.
Why did they do that?
Well, a lot of it, the Japanese are an insular society. They're an island people, unlike the Chinese, who are very broad. That's why we always used to get along better with the Chinese. The Japanese have this tiny island with 100 million people or so on it. They cannot make a fuss because there are too many of them there. They suffer in silence. They contain everything inside themselves. They have this wonderful feeling of being able to cope with their problems, and yet once they get to another country, it's released. And the young man that wouldn't have done anything in Tokyo to draw any attention to himself, when he gets over there, now he can be a boor. Now he can be arrogant to the civilians. Now he can hit them. Hitting goes to killing. Killing goes to atrocity. Unfortunately, it's happened to our own people. The people in Milay, for example, would never have done anything in Missouri or New Jersey when they get over there and they get into... See, battle is something...
That was an aberration, but I just wonder if it was an actual aberration on the part of the Japanese. It looked to be almost an instrument of policy.
Not really policy. I don't think... The policy, of course...
It was condoned by the commanders?
Condoned? No, that's where you're wrong. It was not
well, how would they allow these things to go on as long as it did if it
how
wasn't condoned?
How do we
condoned?
Allow things in New York City to go on in the police department from the top? You know they don't condone it. There are always some people that don't know how to handle force, that they don't know what to do when emotions arise. And so they take these, particularly these farm kids in Japanese, they get out there and they're told to take a position, or there's to defend something, and someone makes a move, and they shoot first. And then shooting soon becomes a habit. Most people don't realize the utter terror there is in war. You've got a gun. In the first place, you probably never handled it before, and then the damn thing shoots, and then you find out that it's a weapon, And it's only something to save yourself and your comrades. And then oftentimes, some people get, I wouldn't say to liking it, but the worst thing is they get used to killing. And the Japanese were not the only ones that committed atrocities. Atrocities have been committed by every nation in the world, including the United States. And the tragedy to me in the trials was that here was the Soviet Union, for example, accusing the Japanese of starting a war, you know, and all this baloney, when they were the ones, they had a pact with Japan, and they are the ones that broke the pact and attacked the Japanese. See, there are no clean hands. No clean hands in the world. We can't be self-righteous. And we must fight all types of atrocities all over, whether they're our own or our brothers.
Although you have returned from Japan not too long ago, that would seem to me that the Japanese are not as insular as they were prior to World War II. Would that attitude have changed now? Is Japan capable of doing what they did, say, during the Bataan Death March
now?
No,
I don't think so. In the first place, now they've gotten out and seen the world, and they are ashamed of the things they did. Now, I know some people on the other side of the world that are not ashamed of the things they did, but the Japanese are. Now, as an American, when I go to visit Hiroshima and Nagasaki, I'm ashamed of that. And I feel very humble when I talk to hundreds who were in those bombings. They hold nothing against me as an American. They sit and eat with me. They want to tell me everything. And they're not thinking of themselves as much as no more Hiroshimas, no more Nagasakis. It's a wonderful attitude. But Japan has not been Americanized, as most people think, unfortunately. They have been changed, and we have added a lot to them in our attempts to democratize them. They already had some democracy before, you know, but we're very good. And the Japanese, for example, the Japanese soldiers that were captured by us, for those in Iwo Jima, for example, would not understand it. When the American Marines fought like devils there, and we flooded them with water, we put gasoline on the water to dry them out, we used fire, we fought horribly. Once they came out, the Marines would say, "Hey, Jack, have a cigarette, give..." They would not understand that. And it ruined a number of those people who came out for Japan to see how could people fight on a Monday like this and then on a Tuesday treat them like human beings. This is our great gift, I think, to the Orient.
Do you speak Japanese?
Very little.
How did you meet your wife?
Well, I was in 1960. I went over to do my book on the first 6 months of Pearl Harbor. I arrived in Japan hating all Japanese. I'd never met one. I'd met many Chinese, but never met a Japanese. Within 2 days, I was at the Sana Hotel, which we ran, and I began to interview people in the Army, the Navy, civilians, and to my amazement, I found out not only that I believed them, but I could equate with them. I found out everything I'd read about the Japanese was full of baloney. You know, they were not the unbelievable ones. In a sense, Americans were more inscrutable than Japanese. And I was interviewing a man named General Nara. He was the commander of all forces on Bataan. And he knew I had gone to Williams College. And he said to me, Amherst, pointed himself, "Lost English, must tell you secret of Bataan." My interpreter was a little Japanese naval officer named Koizumi. He was the grandson of Lafcadio O'Hearn. And he started arguing with Nara. And I said, "What the devil's going on?" He said, "General Nara is trying to tell you something that no Japanese officer should tell." And so I said to Nara, 3 days, same place, good interpreter. That night I went to the Foreign Correspondents Club on Shinmun Alley. You've probably been over there. And I was beefing to Igor Ogonesov of the Wall Street Journal. And he said, "See that girl coming over here? She's one of the best interpreters in Japan. She works for McGraw-Hill." And it was Toshiko Matsumura, and there were bells all over. And I tell you, when I saw her, I had two things in mind. One, to try to get information, and the other was a personal reason. And she was very interested in that. I said, well, I've come over here to listen to Japanese. And she said, most Americans don't. And then she said, they come with 20 questions. And she said, she offered to work at night. So we went back to Nara. He opened up and told this marvelous story of how he had, one of his colonels had climbed Mount Natib to get behind the Americans. He only got halfway there, this terrible mountain. I tried to climb it myself years later and only got halfway up. Then he came back and said he'd like to try it again. Nara said absolutely no. That night he went over with his troops with mountain guns, got behind the Americans, and this is what broke the main Abukai line. But, you see, Nara had gone to Amherst for several years. He knew many Americans, and he also had the feeling that, see, this colonel had disobeyed his officer. Therefore, according to Koizumi, this should be kept quiet. But, see, he wanted to give the colonel who had died the honor of this so his family could be proud of what was one of the great feats of the war. And so then she helped me. After a week or so, I asked her to marry me, and the amazing thing is that she said yes. And, well, we got married, and for the next 20 years, we worked on 7 histories. And then I decided...
And she helps you?
Oh, I couldn't have done the... she's a complete help. She's a collaborator on my Japanese books, because I'm not one of these characters who go in and learn a language. If it's French, I can get along, or German, but Japanese is out of my ken. Besides, I was too busy. And see, her father spoke English with an Oxford accent, and he was very close to many Westerners. He was a samurai, also was a Baptist. But he knew Marcus Kido, for example. They played the same golf course. Through him, I got to see all these top people. And Toshiko would not only be my interpreter, but we would plan campaigns on how do we interview these people and so forth. Now, when we worked on the other side in Europe, she was a great help because she'd be present in all my interviews. And then afterwards, she'd tell me what she thought of the people. And I'm a sort of naive. I'm really innocent abroad. I can be conned. And I know it.
I doubt that.
Well, no, I'm conned because I'm very open. And I think my openness is what gets me to a lot of people. Like, I've interviewed probably 100 people very close to Hitler. And I talk to them as if, you know, I'm just gee whiz. I'm only, what'd you do? Why did you do it? And so forth. I'm not, I don't ask pejorative questions or anything like that. And because I'm really fascinated of how they operate. And so they get under the impression that I'm for them. And so I get very enthusiastic about it. And then afterwards I talk it over with Toshiko. She says, oh, that man is absolutely honest. John, he is conning you. And she was very good at that. It was also good because the Germans looked upon her as, well, they were the ally that didn't give in, you know. And then we go to places like Hungary. We went behind the Iron Curtain to do the last 100 days. Had a marvelous time back in 63. The Hungarians looked upon her as a brother because, you know, they think that the Finns, the Japanese, and the Hungarians come from the same roots. And so every time we'd walk into a restaurant, they'd play Madame Butterfly. And the historians brought out all these anti-Soviet stories for us. So she was a great help. Also, she's my arbiter of taste at home. At Doubleday, I have two editors, Carolyn Blakemore, who's a wonderful editor, and knows nothing about World War II, which is marvelous, and then Ken McCormick, who knows everything about it, and is probably the man with the greatest taste I've ever known. And he keeps me from falling on my face all the time.
John Tolan, you are, of course, well known for the histories that you've written. This is your first work of nonfiction. Did you have any difficulty making that transition to a novel from nonfiction?
Yes, it was. I started life as a playwright when I was 15. I wrote 20 plays, went to the Yale Drama School, and never had anything put on stage. Then I wrote 6 novels. One was bought by Viking, but it was never published. And I think I know damn well why, because I never could put anything together. I had very good scenes always, but I didn't Pat Cavici was my editor, and he says, John, great potentiality, but you don't put things together. And history made me put things together because I didn't have to plot. At the same time, after writing histories, it was difficult thinking in terms. See, I've got two sets of characters, and I list them in the front of the book. The historical characters I treat exactly as they did. I hate these novels that show someone, some famous person, the way they really weren't, or give them the wrong dialogue. I have made up some dialogue, but it was dialogue of people who had told me what they had told to Roosevelt, so I give it to one of my characters to give. But I don't take the historical characters out of context. I do my best to make it as historical as possible. Now, then we have the fictional characters. These are all based on various people, sometimes two or three people, but the things they do, I got from other people, like Will's experiences as a prisoner of war. I didn't make up any of those horrible stories. These are among the 100 or 200 people that I've interviewed over the years who were on the death march and in the death camps. And then for my secondary hero, who was his younger brother, who was a Marine, I went to the Marines and they told me I want a good battalion as guinea pigs. And so they selected the first battalion of the 6 Marines. Had not only a wonderful record, but they had been in the key battles, and also they're a bunch of screwballs, to a marvelous bunch to write about. And its commander, Bill Jones, eagerly went to work with me, and he would be himself, and I would be Mark, and we would work out these things together. So all the things that happened as the Marines did happen. I didn't make up anything. I just put my character in the plot. This has a lot of dangers, too. And I think I could have done better with the characterizations. In the second novel, I'm going to do much better because I'm not going to have World War II as a crutch. The great events of the occupation do not have this marvelous chronology that the war had. I have got to keep to the main themes, the main storyline, of course, is going to be the various war crime trials. Not only the great trials in Tokyo, but we tried some 3,000 others down in Yokohama and other places on other things. And this is an unknown story. I have to more novelize it. I have to take my characters, I'd say, one step deeper. I hope to improve on Gods of War.
John Tolan, you did an enormous amount of research for Gods of War. You are still going through the process of researching the book that will be your second the second part of the trilogy. And you mentioned a moment ago you were anxious to get back to work on that. Do you look forward to the actual writing? Is this kind of a relief after putting together all the facts that you have to sift through and organize in some form? What's easier? What do you like best, the research aspect or the actual writing?
Well, I tell you, research is devilish work. But I like the research because people fascinate me. But then I get filled up to the brim. And then I have to put it all together. And then comes that wonderful moment when you start making your outline and the characters come together. And then the time when you can sit down at the typewriter. I know it's popular for our writers to say they hate to write. I love to write. Now, it's oftentimes very difficult. And some days, oh, God, you don't feel right and nothing seems to work. I keep working. I only write 4 hours a day. I do it at the same time. I'm as regular as X-Lax. And it's a habit of my life. Some days are terrific because everything works. Some days nothing works. I don't revise as I go. I write the whole darn thing. And then I go over it with my editors. And the main thing is to cut out about a third of the stuff that is fat. And then then it starts to really get fascinating with the third draft, when you can start honing it down.
And you're talking about drafts. I mean, you have this book's almost 600 pages. I mean,
that's one of my shorter books. You should have. Rising Hitler was, I think, 1,100 pages.
But you say you just write one draft, go all the way through it, yeah. And then you go back.
That's right. Because, in the first place, I've learned that my first chapter is never going to be what it was, and I learn as I go. And, for example, my characters kept changing. Some would come to me in my dreams, Like, you know, Wilk came to me. I was going to keep him as a prisoner of war until he went on those death ships to Japan. He said, John, I'm getting bored at Cabana Tuan. Let me escape down to Cebu. And he said, remember your old friend Jim Cushing, who was a guerrilla down there? This is a man I knew who had a wonderful story. And I woke up Toshiko. I said, Toshiko, Will had a great idea. And I told her this. Then, fortunately, she remembers everything. I usually forget. Another time, his brother, Mark, who was an agnostic like his brother, like his father, although the father had been born a Catholic, and he came to me and he said he wanted to convert to Catholicism. And because he found the Catholics could handle death better than he. And so I talked to this Bill Jones, who was the Catholic, and I said, what am I going to do? And he says, there's a bishop up in New York who was the head of the military vicariate, and he's an old friend of mine. He used to be a chaplain with the Marines, and he understands this, and he can give you hints. So I sent this bishop about 100 or so pages of my notes on all the characters and other material. And finally, after 2 months, he said he'd see me. I went up in there, and he spent about 6 hours with me. And he explained my characters to me. He explained how you convert and so forth. And then he put me on to people who could help. He just became a cardinal the other day. John J. O'Connor.
No kidding.
Yeah, wonderful fellow. We're going to have dinner with him in a couple of weeks.
Paul Theroux is a writer, told me something interesting. He, I don't know if this applies to you, but maybe you could comment on it. Theroux is a very prolific writer. What he does, he organizes his
work.
What
did he write?
He wrote The Mosquito Coast. That's a terrific book. Yeah. That's one of his. Waldo, Fong and the Indians. He's a novelist primarily. A recent nonfiction book was called Kingdom by the Sea. Uh-huh. But at any rate, when he writes, he thinks about it, sometimes for days, weeks, years. He organizes his characters mentally. He has very good pictures of them. He organizes the plot, the narrative, everything that's going to happen. And he's written the book in his mind, and then he wakes up one day and he says, the book is finished, but I haven't put anything on paper yet. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I can understand. I wish I could do that, but try to do that with Gods of War. Because, first place, I got to hit history, and I got to make it accurate. And this makes it easy in a way, but then it makes it hard because you've got to, you can't fake things with your characters. They've got to act, they've got to stay within the perimeters of the history. And I say, I will have a looser time with Occupation, because there are more opportunities, for example, in working up the cases for the defense of these Japanese, and the marvelous things that happen that will give me more opportunity to do this. So that's why I'm looking forward to it, because it's a different kind of a challenge.
It's a wonderful book, John Tolan. I somehow sense miniseries here. Mm.
Well,
is that a possibility? Is that thing in the works?
Well, my agent says somebody's talking about it out there, they're saying who would you like for this and that and so forth. If Jimmy Stewart were only 30, he'd be great for Will, wouldn't he?
Yeah, he would.
But if we do the thing, I like him to be Skinny Wainwright. Wouldn't he be a great Skinny Wainwright?
He would be now. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah,
now, because Skinny is one of these great characters of history that few people know about. And how about Paul Newman for the Professor McGlynn, you know, who knows all about the Orient, and I think he'd be good.
I'm not sure about that one.
Write down your choices.
Give you my choices? And
yes.
Something.
Uh-huh.
It's a wonderful book, John Tolan. I congratulate you on it, and I'm looking forward to seeing the sequels when they come out. I hope we'll get back together in the same room and talk about them. I know that you're anxious. I know you're talking about the book and doing some appearances about it, but this is what William Kennedy, who won the National Book Critics Circle Award and the Pulitzer Prize himself for fiction, he said, it's giving the book its due. You're now in the process of telling the people about the book so they know about it, and it's very important mm-hmm. that the message about the book is spread.
Yes, well,
it's one thing to write a book, and it's another thing to have it read.
Well, another thing is there's a prejudice among some critics toward World War II. One man said, bring up the nostalgia. Nostalgia? My God. How could he have read the horrible things they go through? This is not nostalgia. We should never forget the things that happened in World War II. World War II is the last war. There will not be a World War III. There might be a short story, but it will not be a war. And this is one reason I'm writing, is to try to prevent something. That's why I'm so eager to get over to work more with the Chinese for books 2 and 3, so I can have an understanding of, and I can get rid of some of my prejudices of the Civil War, for example, or the Korean War. I'd love to get into North Korea to talk to the North Koreans. And otherwise, I want people to see war as not something between America and some other country. War is man's greatest natural disaster. And nobody wins. Everybody loses. I don't glorify war. I horrify war. I glorify those poor bastards that had to fight it.
John Tolan, thank you very much for coming in and talking to me.
Thank you. Sure.